Welcome to episode 35 of Military Veterans Podcast, where we talk to veterans to learn about their stories and experiences. And today we're joined by Murray Hambro. Hello, Murray.
How's it going?
It's going all right. It's going all right. Did it get your name right?
You did.
Yeah. I didn't really think about that.
It's never the Hambro. It's always the Murray.
It's always the Murray. Why?
I don't know. Some people don't know how to say it. Like when they read it off a paper, it's like Murray or Murray or it's crazy.
Awesome. Thanks for coming on the show. How was you known in the military? Was it always Murray or did you have some nicknames?
I think obviously other than the, you know, the swear words, but you know, it was mainly Hammy or Haribo. I think it was one that stuck. That wasn't sure if I wanted it to stick or not, but yeah.
Nice. Well, like I said, thanks for coming on the show. I'm really excited to learn about your time in the military because when we do the summary in a second, the four questions, you're the first of this part of the military. So, All right, let's get the questions out of the way and then we get going. So the questions are, when did you join the military?
November 2002.
Nice. And then what service and branch did you join?
I was in the Army and I was in the Royal Tank Regiment.
Cool. British Army.
Sorry, yeah.
It's all right. That's what I mean. So you're the first tanky. That's your nicknames, right?
Yeah. That's it. And we were the proper tanks as well. So obviously you get the cavalry regiments that obviously once the horses were no good to anyone, they amalgamated onto tanks.
Okay.
But because we are the Royal Tank Regiment, we were the first tank regiment to roll out.
Oh, interesting. See, I don't know too much about tanks apart from they're good to fire things. but it'd be good to hear the differences, maybe a bit of history or something. I don't know what you know. But yeah, that's good. The question number three is, how long did you serve for?
I was just shy of my 12-year point.
Okay.
But yeah.
By a few weeks or months? Or?
Literally a month.
A month, yeah. I was 6 months short myself of 16 years, so you can round up.
I always say 12 years, but then I don't know if I was a bit bitter at the time because it's like I wanted to get that milestone of 12 years. And then, for a lot of people, it's the difference between a half pension or, you know, next to fuck all.
And then the last question is, what rank did you get to?
I made it to the dizzy height of Lance Corporal.
Lance Corporal. Okay, cool. All right, well, Murray, let's rewind the clock. Where was you born and where did you grow up?
So I was born in the southeast in Kent in a small town called Pembury, which is near Tunbridge Wells. And then I grew up in a town called Crowborough, which is not so far away from there. And lived there till I was pretty much 22 when I went into basic training.
Okay. So before you talk about your time in basic training, what was life growing up like? Was you good at school or anything like that?
No, I was far from it. Yeah. for me, my parents went their own separate ways when I was about 12, 13 years old, I think. So my dad moved out and then my mum, she started to see someone else and she was never around. So it was the perfect chance for me to start bunking off school. I grew up on a council estate. It wasn't the roughest, but it certainly had a bad reputation, should I say. So I used to bunk off school whenever I could. The teacher forging letters and stuff like that was never really an issue for me. So my mum was never home. It was just between me and my brother. And then he was a little bit older than me. So as I was going through my teens, he was driving and all sorts. So it was easy to sort of get out and about and, just wreak havoc wherever I could. So, we were little shits, to put it bluntly. We didn't go out looking for trouble, but trouble's quite often found us. For me, I ended up, I used to sort of run drugs and that for some of the local dealers and that. So they were never stupid. They'd never go out and do stuff for themselves. They would get all the teenagers and the kids and stuff to do it. Anyone that wanted their own, I didn't have to pay for my own cannabis or anything because you know, I'd do these little jobs and then, you know, I'd get it for free. But then I started to, you know, deal a little bit in it, deal a little bit myself. And then, you know, that's where the trouble started to come into things. And yeah, it got to a point where I was, my house got raided for drugs. And then I think my mum wasn't paying the rent on the house. And then we got evicted from the house. And I owed one of the dealers a little bit of money. I think it wasn't a lot. It's like less than 100 quid.
Okay.
And he came knocking on my door because what I was doing was that I would use different dealers. So I'd go to one dealer to get some cannabis. I never did any of the Class A stuff. That was, you know, too much for me. But you'd go to one dealer and you would get it on tick. So you'd take the drugs, you'd sell it and then give the money back. But what I was going from one to the other to the other. So there was three different ones. And then I was kind of paying one off to pay off the next. So things kind of got a little bit out of control, but not massively. But one day, one of the dealers came round to my house and he's like, oh, you know, someone owes me money. Do you mind going knocking on the door? Because if I knock on the door, they won't answer or they'll just bolt out the back door and that. So I didn't think anything of it. But we went down this country lane. I was like, no one lives down here. What's going on? And they didn't say anything. And then all of a sudden they pulled up in this little parking area, dragged me out of the car, started to rough me up a little bit. And one of the guys pulled out a gun and then held it to my face. And it's like, you're going to pay me the money and all this stuff. And that was the first time I ever had a gun sort of pointed in my face or anything. And I didn't laugh, but I just smiled. And I didn't know because I just thought it's a BB gun or a blank fire. It didn't look like a real gun, but it was the scare tactic. And yeah, so like I say, they sort of roughed me up a little bit. And it was only that sort of point that they drove off. They left me to walk home. And I was walking home and I was like, fucking hell, okay, this is going to be my life, isn't it? So I've got to make two choices. So my granddad, my dad's dad, he was in the artillery. He was a major in the artillery. And his dad before that was, I think he was a lieutenant colonel. So there's always been military in the family, but it was only my dad that he was told he was never allowed to join the army. Well, that's what he told me anyway. Mm-hmm. But he told me he was never allowed to join the army, so he couldn't live that life. But I loved the stories of what my granddad used to sit me on his knee, tell me stories, and you'd look up going, one day, granddad, I'm going to be in the army. And it was at that point I was kind of walking back thinking, fuck, what am I going to do? And that was it. You know, the next day or so afterwards, I got on the bus, went into Tunbridge Wells and enlisted into the army.
Okay. So you had maybe late teens, early 20s doing that dodgy stuff and...
Yeah, yeah.
And it was...
So I kind of drifted between jobs. I was a panel beater. I was a tree surgeon for a little while. That was just before I joined the army. That was kind of where I was making a bit of money mm-hmm. before then. And yeah, just kind of drifting from job to job.
And then it was that walk back that kind of enticed you to make that final step of actually
I guess it's a little bit cliche in some cases. Like some people are like, you know, is he going to go to prison or join the army? And, you know, is that I had to do the right thing or, you know, whatever road you choose.
And before that, had there been any inkling that, you know, one day, I know you said about sitting on your knee and saying, granted, I'll do it one day, but was there anything in your teens and early 20s that you're like, I think I will give it a go?
I always talked about the RAF.
Oh, did you? Okay.
Yeah. So, I guess it was the idea of flying planes and doing all that sort of thing. But then I was realistic and thought, fucking hell, I never went to school. So they've got no hope flying a plane.
Right.
When I went into the careers office, I don't think I really had a clue.
Okay.
But then back then you still had to do the BARB test. So I did the BARB test and I don't know if I've got good common sense or what, but I actually scored really high on the BARB test. And they said, well, you've got the choice of any career path that you want in the army. So you could be a helicopter pilot, a field surgeon, you could do whatever you want. But you don't have the GCSEs. So these are now your options.
Right,
yeah,
right, right.
So then it left me with infantry cannon fodder or tanks. And then they showed me the tank. They showed me the video of like all the different jobs. And you see there was Challenger 2 going across the prairies in Canada or whatever it was, doing live firing. I was like, yeah, that's a bit of me.
That. Yeah.
So that's when I decided, you know, I wanted to go on heavy armor.
So for anybody that doesn't know, we do have some great people around the world listen to this podcast and some civvies, which is great. Now, I can't remember 100%, but I also did the BARB test when I joined, because we joined a similar time. And I'm trying to remember what that stands for, because it is an acronym for something, isn't it?
It's
like basic assessment. I don't know. I don't think it is that, in fact. It stands for something. But basically, if we explained, it's kind of like...
You'd have to Google it, wouldn't you?
Yeah, they could Google it. But you do like maths, don't you? And you do like some, so if this person...
It's like problem solving, isn't it?
Problem solving, yeah.
So it's like how many, they'll have a shape around other shapes and how many times does this shape fit into this box and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
And it's the time it takes you to answer it and whether or not you get it right or whatever. And
they were on really crappy old computers, weren't they?
Yeah, exactly. It was like the old ones where you had to wait for, you know, 20 minutes for it to load up and all sorts. So...
But you then was given those options, saw the tank video, and you were like, yeah, I'll do some of that. So did you go in knowing that you'd be, is it a tank driver? Is that your role?
Yeah, so you get two options. You can either go, you either start as a gunner or a driver. So one of my best mates that I grew up with, he actually joined the tank regiment first. So at least I had a bit of... inside information.
Right.
And so he was sort of telling me, you know, make sure you don't go for any of the cavalry ones, join the Royal Tank Regiment and all this. So that was when I went through career saying, okay, well, I wanted, because the local catchment for me was the Queen's Royal Hussars. And, you know, they're a cavalry regiment.
Right.
But I was like, no, I want to be tanks. I want to be proper tanky. Okay. So I want to be Royal Tank Regiment. So requested that, and that's when they said, you know, when you go through basic training, you go through as a basic infantry.
Yeah.
And then your phase two training is when you go down to Bovington, down in Dorset, and you'll either be selected as a gunner or a driver.
Oh, okay, so you don't get a full choice in what you're going to do?
No, not really. Well, you don't. I think it depends on the intake at the time and how many people are doing what courses and what roles and all that sort of stuff. So
makes sense.
When I went through basic training, I got to phase two and the guys were just deploying out to Iraq. So all the tank parts and everything was taken away from Bovington and it was all being shipped out to Iraq. So a lot of the courses were delayed.
Right.
Because... they were, there wasn't enough parts to service the training tanks and everything else. So it took a little bit longer for me to go through my phase two than it normally would.
Okay.
So,
before you go any further with that, I just want to talk about phase one.
Yep.
So basic training.
Yep.
Where did you do your basic training?
Winchester.
Winchester.
Yeah,
okay.
It was down at the Winchester.
And how did you find that? Was you any good at anything in particular? And how did you find the physical training aspect?
It really surprised me, to be honest, because of how I grew up. I had no discipline. I had no authority. I didn't know how I would respond to it, but I absolutely loved it. Basic training was probably the best bit. Well, not the best bit of my army career, but for those, 12 weeks? I think it was 12 weeks. Your life is just so busy. You had no time to think, no time to react. You're so tired in the evenings. Like going to bed at 10 o'clock, you'd always laugh and say, I don't go to bed. I don't even think about going to bed until midnight. But you were that tired from the day and you knew you was getting up early the next day that you didn't have a choice. And, you know, I was 22 years old and I was on a drinking bat. I wasn't allowed to drink for, I think, the first 6 weeks.
Oh, yeah.
being told that you're gated and all this. It's not good, is it? It's not really, it's not going to draw you into the army, but I loved it. It never bothered me.
And how did you find that as a 22-year-old, like you mentioned? So you're, you know, not saying you were old, but most people...
Compared to everyone that I was with.
Yeah.
You know, there's... what is it? To do basic training, you have to be 18, don't you?
Well, I think 17, I think you can get in.
Is it 17 or do you not have to go up to...
I think if you join at 16, you have to go to Harrogate.
That's it,
But I think if you're... like I was
17 and a half or something, yeah, yeah.
Well, I was 16 and like... 8 or 9 months or something, and I went straight to basic. I didn't even know about Harrogate. I wish I did. But I went straight to basic. So I'm guessing over, like, if you're touching on 17, probably when you pass out, as long as you're 17.
I think 17. That's what they go off, isn't it? Yeah. It's like from the point when you pass out.
Yeah.
But
all youngsters, right? So
yeah,
you were an old git.
I was. I think there was me and one other guy that was in our 20s and everyone else was still in their teens. But... I think I was ready for it. I think I got rid of all that rebellious stuff. I loved having the structure, the discipline. I guess because, you know, my mum was never home for me when I was at home. Looking after myself was easy. Doing all the cleaning, the block jobs and all that sort of stuff. You know, once someone had shown me how to use Brasso, it wasn't a problem, but I already knew how to iron. I already knew how to cook and clean and stuff like that. It was only the little things. It was entertaining when the corporals are there teaching the young lads how to shave and stuff like that. So if you were 17, I suppose you would have been there yourself. Yeah. Going, but that was good. I mean, I wouldn't necessarily say that some of the guys sort of looked up to me as a... not a father figure, but obviously being an older person, there was a little bit respectful. I wasn't a gobby little bastard either. So I was learning how to play the game. So for me, the army was about playing the game. Once you figured out how to play it, it's the easiest job in the world. And it was the best job in the world.
Yeah.
You know, when we talk about transitioning to Civvy Street, I mean, it just blows my mind how easy I had it in the army. There was a few times where it's tough. But, you know, even with the basic training, the physical aspect of it, going for the runs and all that sort of thing, I'd never done it before. I was still a 20-a-day smoker.
Okay.
So I struggled a little bit with my fitness initially. And then the tabbing, the loaded march, you know, that was a whole new experience. But, you know, they build you up into it. I think one of the funniest things for me was like the gas chamber, getting CS gas and all that lot. You know, the guy before me, this what was his name, Swanee or something. He was this little Scottish lad. He was about 16, he was like 17, 18 years old. He was immune to CS. So he stood there, he rattled off his name, rank and number, and the corporal was having a chat with him. And he's like, "Right, you little bastard, get out of my chamber." And he just goes strutting out. So I was like, "It can't be that bad, surely." And then I was next. I had to take my gas mask off. He's like, "Name, rank and number." So as soon as I said it, obviously you say it as you're breathing out. So you're like, 2515, you know, Trooper Murray Hambro and all that. And he's like, "Breathe in." So then you take that breathe in and then you're like, yeah. You're coughing, you got sweat, snot, like tears coming out everywhere. And then, yeah, I mean, that was kind of my first experience of, oh, wow, what's this like? And then, you know, after that, I think you go on your first exercise. They're looking for things with your kit. If there's one little thing wrong, then you're leopard crawling down. And because it was in the wintertime, you know, there was, the ground was still rock solid with the frost. And your leopard crawling down, getting cut to pieces and all that sort of stuff. But I still did it with a smile on my face. I was like, this is great. This is awesome. And then when I first handled a rifle, someone actually said to me, like, is it irony? Is that the right word? Of having a gun pointed in my face. To then me pointing a gun at other people.
Mm.
Is that the thing that kind of, is that why, you know,
Is that what drove you to do it?
Yeah, is that what drove me to do it? And then for me to actually point a gun at other people, you know, was it, did it stem from that? And I never really thought about it. And yeah, it was just really weird.
Mm. Was there anything in basic that you were really good at, or was you just like average at all?
I would like to say shooting, I was pretty good, but I never really tried to advance it. So with the SA-80s, I never failed an APWT. With the 50 cal, you know, chopped targets down in half, always hit the targets. With the Challenger, I only ever did one range package on Challenger. But, you know, past all that, everything, and I loved shooting. I mean, it's even now, it's the one thing that I miss, is shooting. But, yeah, the only thing I couldn't shoot was bloody pistol. It's just point and then hope. So, yeah, it always made me laugh, like the movies and that. You see people, like, dropping this person from 300 metres away. It's like, bollocks to that, mate. Anything more than 25 metres and I'm screwed.
Yeah. So you complete basic, pass out, and then you mentioned earlier about going to phase two, which is in Bovey, Dorset area. That's where, is it just the Royal Tank Regiment go, or do all tankies go there?
All tankies go to Bovington, and I think the Armoured Engineers go down there as well.
Okay.
Because that's where they do all their bridge laying stuff as well.
Right. I was never armoured, so.
Yeah. So, no, I think it's just the... yeah, it's purely just for the tanks, I think.
Okay. And how did you find that? You know, you've gone from learning the CS gas and stuff.
Yeah.
Oh, by the way, when you spoke about that, it made me like taste it in my mouth.
It does.
But yeah, how did you find Bobby? What did you think of that?
Again, loved it. It was just, it was all a new experience. So you go from basic training where everyone's screaming and shouting, you do this, do that. You know, I getting beasted up and down the drill square all the time, to then go to Bovington where it's more chilled out. You know, they turn around and say, right, you haven't got to have the itchy, scratchy blankets in your, how many was there? I think there was 10 to a room in basic training. And then you go to Bovington where it's like 2 to a room and you're allowed a duvet, pillows, you get all the like the luxury, the finer luxuries. And, I mean, it was great. It was just a bit more chilled out. You know, you wasn't being marched everywhere, but there were certain places around the block where you had to march. If you was in more than a group of four, you had to march. If it was less than that, then you could just kind of walk normally. So, funnily enough, everyone chose to walk around it. If there was one of your mates come along, you're like, fuck off. No, because we're going to have to start marching. So, you know, that was the only difference. But there you was kind of learning a bit more. You did signals, you did you did basic map reading and basic training, but then they start to develop it a little bit more, and then you get the D&M side, so the driver maintenance for the tanks. The signals cracked me up, because I mean it was still Batco, it was all Klansman back then. Do you remember that?
Yeah.
So
that's like decoding and coding.
Yeah, exactly. So you had your Batco wallet out, and the thing is with the tanks is like we use Brevco as well.
Oh, what's
so,
that?
So it's very much the same as Batco.
Right.
So you'll get the, because you had morning and afternoon, I think.
Yes.
And then you'd have, in the morning, you'd have all the code sheets and everything else. So they would tell you Brevco, go to what page. And then it's kind of easier to write down than what it is with the normal Batco wallets.
Okay.
And because when you're in a tank, you're rolling along. And I did one exercise as an operator. And you're kind of rolling along, trying to make brews. You're trying to, you know, make sure the coax gun's all sorted, or you're loading the main armament. And then all of a sudden, someone's sending stuff over the radio. And the commander's like, did you get that? I was like, what? You're having a laugh. So... yeah, learning all that sort of, learning all the Klansmen was exciting. I mean, it just blew my mind. And then going into the D&M stuff. So that was probably the cool bit, because that's where I started off as a driver. So you see the learner tanks. So it's a normal Challenger, but it has like a little glass turret on the top instead of the gun. And driving around Bovington training area, you felt like a king, especially when they let you out on the roads and all these people in the cars are like, oh, fucking hell. Because some people couldn't drive. So the instructor, it's not like a learner car. Your driving instructor would lean across and start moving the steering wheels or whatever. Okay. All you have is this instructor going, fucking left, left.
So did you have to pass like a car license before you got into the
Yeah. So you have to have your driving license.
Right.
Before you can do your H license, which is your track vehicle license.
Okay.
You would think that you would learn on a small vehicle before you go onto the big boys. I think days of old, like they did it on 432s. Do you remember those?
Yeah.
So the big, the medium box tanks, aren't they? But then they stopped doing that and we were just going straight onto Challenger 2. So your Challenger 2 is the width of the road.
Two lanes?
Well, just one lane.
Just one lane.
But it's from white line to curb.
Right.
One little mistake and you've just annihilated a curbstone. And the local council is like real hot on curbstones. And because some of the people that are sort of a bit ropey drivers and that, they were just going up the curbs, going into the middle of the road and all sorts. So yeah, you'll get people driving towards you, flashing their lights at you because you might be a little bit over the white line. And you're like, well, buddy, you're going to move out of the way. Otherwise, because, you know, the size of this thing, I'm going to come barreling through anyway. And but that's what made it funny, because the instructors, they got patience of a saint, because some of these young lads couldn't drive for shit, going up the curbs, going all over the place.
Because in my head, when you're doing this, it's like the tank, I don't know what it's called now, but it's the off-road part. Like I'm thinking in my head, like Salisbury Plain, like that. But you're driving where there's
main roads.
Curbstones.
On main roads, yeah. So if ever you've been down to Dorset and stuff like that, it's a holiday hotspot. So all the tourists and that are always going down, driving through Dorset to get to Weymouth, Bovington to get to Weymouth and stuff like that. So you get the people with their caravans and all sorts. So the roads were quite busy quite a lot of the time. And so that's what always kind of made me laugh. Like a main battle tank isn't a small vehicle. You know, it's probably wider than a lorry. So that's why it was always entertaining for me. Like I was always driving with a big broad grin on my face. It's like, you know, you're always heads up on the road.
Right.
But then off road, then, you know, occasionally they'll get you to close down hatch. And that's when you're sort of, you're looking up to the sky. You're laying on the flat of your back looking for a periscope.
Okay.
Driving along. But yeah, you kind of have to advance to that stage to drive and close down. And then they do the night driving and the night sights and all that sort of stuff afterwards.
So you mentioned about doing like a H license. So is it broken down to different segments and you have to pass each individual thing? Or is it kind of like a car license where you just go on a big test and they test you?
Yeah, yeah. So... did you have to do any of like the, what is it called? Where the familiarization and all that sort of stuff. So every new vehicle, you had to do a test on it. So whether it was Land Rover, driving a van, whether it was a truck, you always had to do some sort of assessment for it. So it was the same as that, really.
Right.
But to be able to drive on a UK road, you had to have the H part on your license.
Okay.
But yeah, I think it was about 6 weeks to do the course. So once you've got your car license, technically you're supposed to be safe to drive on the roads, but you know, some of the lads is a bit ropey whether or not they got their car license.
Now I'm gonna be chucking some silly questions at you. Like already I've asked some silly questions about like how wide is it or the width of the road. Anyway, did you have to take your tank to the knife edge?
Yeah,
I've heard of the knife edge. Yeah. So in fact I've been in a tank going, I'm sure I've been at Bovey as well. Anyway, it doesn't matter, but like, can you explain what the knife edge is, and is it just to enable your skill to be better, or is it part of the test?
Nah, there's no real relevant. There's no real reason why they get you to do it other than control.
Okay.
So the knife edge is it's a big steep bank. It's a massive incline, and it kind of points at the top, doesn't it? So it's I think it's about a meter wide at the top, but it's like 10 meters wide at the bottom. But it's about this. Is it? Would you say it's the size of the house? It's probably about the height of a house. So yeah. It's a decent height. So the tank, because the incline is so steep, you have to control the tank. And then when you go over the top, as it kind of crests over the top, you have to control the weight of the tank going over the top. And, you know, you're supposed to get it to balance and kind of teeter back and forth on the top. And then the instructor will say, drive on. And then that's when you sort of put it into, you know, you keep driving over the top and then go down and over the other side.
Mm.
I don't think there's any real kind of relevance to it other than control.
Control, yeah. Because I've been in the back of a tank and I'm sure it was at Bovington. It was either there or it was in Germany. Anyway, it's irrelevant. But being in the back, not being able to see anything, it's like you're on a freaking roller coaster.
Yeah.
Because you're going up and then you feel that balance, that like you said, teetering. And
well,
then
it is steep. Like it's when you're going up, like if you're a passenger, it kind of really sits you in the back of the seat. And then as a driver, all you're seeing is daylight.
Yeah.
And you don't get anything. And you're just going off the feel of, you know, when you get over the top, you get that kind of gravity pulling you down. And you just have to take your foot off the gas, let it come up. It'll either go all the way up or over, or you're getting back on the gas, or some guys just floored it over the top.
Oh, no.
And then the instructors are just like, as they're going over the top. Because like some of the guys, their heads would be out the turret. So as it goes over, it smashes down over the other side. And the amount of people that are probably broken ribs and stuff like that going over.
Yeah, yeah.
But, thankfully that wasn't me.
So you complete phase two. Everything's good, right? Or did you have to do something again? I don't know.
No, that was all just ticking boxes, really. You get the qualifications you need to be able to go to regiment. So once you've qualified as a signaller, once you've been given your job on the tank, so whether it's gunner or driver, so the gunners went to Lulworth.
Oh, yeah, okay.
Which is still down at Bovington. But you're trained about the same time to become a gunner. And then once you've done that, you can go off to regiment.
And you said you were a driver? Is that what you got?
Yeah, I was a driver, yeah.
And
that's
what you really wanted, wasn't it?
Well, yeah. I think so. But then it was the unknown, wasn't it? So if you didn't know what job you was going into, you kind of don't know what you want. Because, you know, when you go on the tanks, you don't just stay a driver your whole career. You have to learn every single position in the tank. So you start as a driver. As soon as you get to regiment, at some point you'll become a gunner. As soon as you become a gunner, then your next step is an loader operator. And then, you know, if you make it that far, you become the commander afterwards.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Yeah. That's so, cool. Once, like I say, at Bovington, I had to sit around for a little bit because of Iraq. My regiment was one of the first ones to deploy out. And then, once they were starting to come back, then that's when I was shipped off out to Germany.
Okay, so that was your first posting. So before we talk about that, I just want to confirm I've got things correct in my head. So, tank regiment.
Yep.
Black beret.
Yep.
Black coveralls.
Black coveralls,
yeah. Or are they overalls? What's the difference? I don't know if there is a difference.
They're coveralls. I'm not sure what the difference. I don't know if overalls is because it's an overgarment, but we were just wearing the coveralls.
So that was your uniform, essentially.
Yeah.
Cool. Just wanted to make sure I got that in my head.
Yeah. So that's why we were always known as the Men in Black, because like one of the traditions of the tank regiment was that we wore black berets because in World War II, World War I, the oil stains and all that sort of stuff. You wouldn't see it. And that's the same with the black coveralls and stuff like that.
Fair. So post out of Germany, was that like one of your preferences? Is that where you wanted to go or?
No, that's just where my regiment was. So at that point, there was 1 and 2 RTR. So the first Royal Tank Regiment, the second. I think at one point there was like 8 different tank regiments.
Right.
But over time, they all amalgamated. And then when I was there, you had one RTR, which was like all the jocks and the scousers, all the northerners and all that sort of thing. And then two RTR was all the southerners. So, yeah, one RTR was based in Suffolk, and then Suffolk and Salisbury down at, not Tidworth, Warminster.
Okay.
And, two RTR was Fallenbostel over in Germany. So, yeah, I was shipped off over to there.
And then how did you find it going to your first unit?
Loved it.
Yeah.
Well, I say I loved it. I mean, the first, it's like most things, isn't it? It's making friends again. You get out there because I think there was two of us that went out there at the same time. So you go there, they get put into a different squadron. For us, you have like platoons and companies. We have squadrons and then troops.
Okay, same as engineers, that is.
Yeah. Okay. So, yes, we were put into different squadrons, and then, it's like everyone's just come back from Iraq, so everyone's like on their high horse going, look at all this new guy. So I kind of had a bit of a tough time at first. There's always a few people that sort of take you under their wing and stuff like that, which is great. And it didn't take too long before I started to make friends. But the squadron that I was a part with, because they came back from Iraq, they went on R&R. So the regiment was deserted for probably the first 6 to 8 months. So regimental life for me was really quiet. It wasn't really too busy. All the tanks and that were still out in Iraq, so there wasn't really a lot going on. And within, I think, 3-4 months of me being over in Germany, there was an option to go on a tour out to Cyprus on Optosca, I think it was. So I put my name down for that. And then, just as all the guys and that were coming back off R&R, they told me I was going out to Cyprus.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so naturally everyone in the regiment hated me even more because I was going out to Cyprus for 6 months
right.
They were, stuck in Germany. But
so before we move on to Cyprus, what was it like for you going to Germany? Was that your first time away from the UK?
Yeah, well, the first ever holiday I had was when I was, I think it was about 18, 19, and I went to Tenerife, Playas de las Americas, and that was the first time I'd been out of the UK.
Right, right.
So this was the second time I'd been out of the UK, and I was permanently based out of it.
Yeah.
But Fallenbostel was a garrison town. So the good thing for me is that everyone spoke English. Like, the Germans spoke better English than the English. And because we had the Black Watch over the road, you had the Scottish. And we even had the Scots DG, the Scots Dragoon Guards, so which is another tank regiment, but they're a cavalry regiment, so they're not perfect. But they were like round the back of us. So we were surrounded by all these Scots. So that, I think that was my first kind of real, I don't know what the word is, my first time being around all that, all these different people, trying to understand the Scottish when they're on the piss, mate.
Yeah, I bet, yeah.
It's hard work. So yeah, that was kind of being around those, being around the Germans and everything else. It was exciting. It was good. Fallenbostel kind of had everything it needed. You had Cha-Cha Bongos, what everyone called it. It was like the local nightclub. You had the Pink House down the road, which was the local brothel, which is always, it's almost like an initiation.
Really?
Like, you get out to Germany, you have to go to Pink House and shag a prostitute and that. I was like, okay.
Oh, bloody hell.
Are you paying on me? It's like, oh, you're paying for everyone. I was like, okay.
And then you mentioned about getting out there, and I just want to ask, what's the rank that you are as a like entry level in the tank regiment?
Yeah, trooper.
Trooper. Okay, yeah, I couldn't remember what it was. So infantry is private, engineers is sapper.
Yeah.
So it's trooper for the tankies, yeah?
Yeah, yeah. And then everything else is the same. It's, you go trooper, lance corporal, corporal, sergeant, all that. So,
okay. Yeah. And then, I had another question. Hang on, it's gone now. It might come back to me, doesn't matter. so you mentioned about getting selected to go out to Cyprus on, yep. on your first tour. That was a question. What year is this that you get out there? Is it like 2004 or not quite?
I think it was 2004.
Okay. Because Iraq started 2003, didn't
yeah,
it?
Early yeah, early 2003.
Like March, I think it was, yeah. 2003. So they'd been out there. Yeah, cool. And then you just get out there 2004. Yeah, that was the question. See, I knew it'd come back. yeah, so Cyprus. You knew you were going out there. You know, what's your mindset at that point?
I didn't really know what to make of it. It was my first tour. You know, you always kind of think, oh, it's going to be like guns, guts, glory and all that sort of stuff. People always talk about, you know, the Greeks and the Turks, how they're going to be, you know, whether it's hostile, how to manage it and all that sort of thing. And then you go through all your pre-deployment training and you're doing like riot training and all this. And I'm thinking, crap, I mean, what are we going to? And it was good building up to it, doing all the training. They kind of teach you about certain things with the Greeks and the Turkish, like things that you shouldn't do, how to talk to them. If they're trying to, like a lot of the time they would try and antagonize each other or whatever. So then you it was more like you was a parent. Right. Just stood in the middle like, hey, mister, hey, UN, he's, you know, he shouldn't be over there. He shouldn't be doing this. They got too many men on the post and all this sort of stuff. And you're like, look, dude, don't worry about it. Like, they're all right, just chill. Because a lot of the time it was just one person on the post. And, you know, I'd be on my post on my own. There'd be two Greeks and one Turkish, and the Turkish is shouting at me because there's two Greeks over there. And you're like, oi, mate, just play the game, will you? Just go off, you know, do whatever. And that was kind of summed up the tour. I don't know what it was like in previous years and whether or not it was worse than that. But for me, it was just kind of a holiday, to be fair. Really? We were doing like 7 days on, 7 nights on, and then 7 days off. And in the 7 days off, you have Paphos, Iron Appa, you know, Nicosia. You could go wherever you wanted. But when I got out to Cyprus, it was just after, I think it was the Green Jackets. I think two Green Jackets got done for murder, like murdering a girl on the beach. So then squaddies weren't allowed in Iron Appa anymore. So the RMPs would be sort of loitering down there trying to catch squaddies going out clubbing and stuff. And everyone was like, oh, don't take your army ID or whatever. It's like, you can spot a squaddie from a mile away. Mm. But, you know, if an RMP comes up to you and says, are you a squaddie? No, mate. I don't know what about. I don't know, that was it. You just carried on about your business.
Yeah, yeah. And how long was that tour in total?
6 months.
6 months, okay. And you mentioned it being part of the UN.
Yeah.
So does that mean you got to wear a blueberry?
Yeah.
You did?
Yeah, yeah, blueberry, UN cap badge. And that's about as glorious as it was. We got to drive the UN 4x4s all down the buffer zone and that. It was just like, it was like a rally course. It was pretty easy going as tours go, but the only thing you had to be mindful of is in the buffer zone, there were certain parts which there was minefields and you weren't allowed to go into a lot of the derelict buildings because, you know, the Greeks and the Turks booby-trapped it for each other. So until the engineers came along and cleared it all, then, you know, that was all out of bounds.
Fair enough. Now, that UN tour, not many people, like percentage wise probably a really low percentage from the British Army have done that, so that's quite a unique thing.
I don't know, I think there's quite a few.
Yeah,
I think the British contingency has been out there for a fair few years.
We have, but yeah. I know you are the sixth person I've known, so like unless people don't talk about it, but there's not many people that have got that experience.
A lot of people don't really associate it as a tour though, to be fair.
Yeah, maybe.
Like I say, it was a holiday for me. You was going down to Paphos and that, just all these girls on holiday and that, oh, what do you do? It's like, I work here. Oh, what do you do? I'm in the army. And it was just like, here's a room key, see you later. I was like, sweet.
Sounded like good fun.
It was.
So after that, come back. Back to your unit, and I'm guessing you then have to reintegrate yourself because they've all come back from leave.
Yeah, for sure. Everyone's kind of just trying to think what the regiment was up to at the time. I don't think there was really anything going on. It was a real quiet spell before Afghan really started to kick off. And again, because the tanks were still out in Iraq still, and then a lot of them was going into storage with like fleet management and all that lot, because the army was just starting to downscale. So we had tanks taken away and put into storage, so we was doing that. And yeah, it was just kind of exercise, I think. A lot of the time we was either out on exercise in Germany. We did an awesome one out in Poland. I was out there for, I think, 7 weeks. By that point, I'd come off the Challengers and I was onto the Scimitars. So I did recce.
Okay.
For a few years. And, you know, out of the two, I loved the Scimitars more than the Challengers, just because they were so much fun to drive. And then...
What, because they were more nimble or...?
Yeah, more nimble, faster. Like when they go wrong, you know, you can hit it with a club hammer instead of a sledgehammer. And it was just so much more easier to manage. Whereas Challenger, everything was so big, so heavy. And like, you know, you needed a shovel to clear out the tracks. Whereas a Scimitar, you just get a hammer and you just give the track a knock and it all falls off. So it was it was just so much more nicer to work with. But yeah, so we went out to Poland and we just absolutely dominated it. We went out there as Op 4, so we was playing the enemy.
Okay.
And then the battle group just had no idea what was going on. Like, we absolutely smashed them. And it was probably one of the best exercises that I'd done, that we actually enjoyed doing it. Because most exercises, you're cold, you're wet, you can't be bothered. You just want to go home every single time. But now I loved it with Poland.
That's cool. And then what's like the next big thing after that? Because you mentioned Afghan a few times. So was that the next tour for yourself?
Yeah, 2007. It was... Herrick 9, I think. Yeah, I think it's either 8 or 9. I can't remember now. Which we went out on Mastiff. We was one of the first. We was the first ones to go out to take Mastiff, and it was still as Afghan was still very kinetic. So the Taliban was still taking us on one on one, and you know they were just having a few shots, run off, or do whatever, but. It was kind of around that time, I think they were learning from Iraq about with all the IED stuff. So, you know, I don't know if they were having a confab with themselves and just saying like, you know, stop taking on the British and the Americans with small arms. You need IEDs. Like, you get a much better success rate. So I think it was at that point they were just starting to drop off, taking us on. And then I think it was... just as we left there, that's when Afghan changed as well with the rules of engagement. What was the general's name? Changed it all, didn't he?
I don't know.
The Americans and that. I think they changed it. That's going to bug me now. But they turned around and said it was all about hearts and minds. So we wasn't allowed to take on the Taliban as we used to.
Oh, was it Petraeus? Or it might not have been him. That's the only name that's come to my head. But anyway, yeah, I know what you mean.
But there was a real switch.
Just changing it, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So when we was out there, I mean, the first time I was out in Afghan, you know, it was, again, you know, some of the Americans used to laugh at us because we looked like cavemen. Like, we looked so scruffy. Guys were walking around with cut-off shorts, cut-off T-shirts. You know, we didn't have the same kit as what a lot of the Americans had, you know, and trying to, I think they wanted us to look like more professional soldiers. So then they started saying, right, you had to wear trousers, you had to wear a shirt around camp, you had to do this, you had to wear, you know, do whatever. And it kind of, it changed a lot over that tour. But, you know, thankfully everyone came back. I think we had maybe one or two IED strikes, but no one was injured to that point. So we were really lucky on that tour. Everyone all came back in one piece. You know, we went down, we were holding Sangin, so we were down in Sangin, and where else were we? We was working at a Fob Rob, which is just down outside of Sangin. And I mean, it was pretty exciting at times. Mm-hmm. And it just kind of, it was that up and down all the time. People coming in all the time, like gunshot wounds, whether or not they stepped on anti-personnel mines. For me, that was my first real tour, my first eye opener, and I was like, Jesus, when you're in the firefights, my Mastiff got RPG'd, and I was sat in the back of my Mastiff reading a Nuts magazine, whilst my commander, he was on out the turret, you know, on Overwatch, and we didn't realise that it was like a trench system. This Taliban crawled along the trench system, popped up, firing a armor-piercing RPG, and it kind of went through the back corner of the Mastiff, and I remember sticking my head up. I didn't realise that Jimmy, my commander, had the GMG, so the grenade machine gun, over the back half of the hatch. So as I stuck it up, he just started firing. I was like, not only did my ears start ringing, I nearly had a grenade into the back of my head as well. So I was like, fucking hell. But I think that was my first real contact. And then after that, it just, you know, there was, we was up in Fob Fox, which was just a hilltop, and we were just living out of trenches. We had the rockets coming in, and we would always laugh because we'd run and jump into the trenches. You had a poncho over the top, and that was us. We was looking for cover under this little bit of plastic tarpaulin, essentially. And we're like, we're really safe. And then you just sat there. I don't know if it was fear or just hysterics or whatever, but we'd all be laughing and just thinking, fucking hell, what are we doing? But, it's crazy. And I think it was Fob Fox. The Estonians took a massive hit. There was a group of vehicles inside a compound, and they got a lucky shot with one of the Chinese rockets inside the compound, and the Estonian medic and all that lot, they was in pieces, and we all went running in, and everyone who was a team medic had a team medic's kit. We had to run in and just stand by this wall as you're watching people just sort of going all over the place, and if you were called forward, then you were just sort of getting all your dressings out and doing whatever. And I think fortunately for me, I didn't have to get called forward, but there was a few friends. We was always admiring this one Estonian medic. She was hot. I mean, I know we've been on tour for 3 months, but she was still hot. And she was in quite a bad way as well. So, my friend went up to her and gave her all the first aid and stuff. And then the next day, they went off the hilltop, and they just rolled through like three villages, just smashing all the Taliban as they were going through.
Oh, okay.
It was almost like I don't know what you want to call it. It was like a revenge mission or something like that.
Yeah.
And we were just stood on the top of the hilltop, just watching them roll through, hearing all the gunshots. And that was like, fucking hell, fair one. But crazy tour that was.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
It's like you say, your first... In your words, like your first proper tour, But was that 6 months as well?
Yeah, six months.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah. That was a summertime tour as well, so it's fucking hot.
Hot. Yeah, yeah. So with the Mastiff, I think hopefully most people know what size that is, but it's like a big truck, I suppose.
About a four-ton truck. Yeah.
Four-ton truck.
Yeah, yeah.
And did you have the bar armor at that point?
Yeah. So we had the bar armor, and then you had all the side armor on the top.
Okay.
I mean, the vehicle was so heavy.
Mm.
It had no off-road capability, which is what I think they were hoping for. But a lot of the time we went across the desert, we'd end up getting stuck. And then the Marines would come along laughing their head off because they're in the Vikings.
Right.
And they were having to tow us out. And they're like, fucking tankies. It's like,
oh, brilliant, brilliant. So you shared some really cool things from that tour. It's always good to hear like people's experiences. And I'm guessing at this point you're well connected with your regiment, with your troop, with your squadron, and then you will come back. So is it a case of going on leave again and then starting to prepare for somewhere else?
Yeah, so I mean, you get the normal R&R. I think it's about a month off, and then you start, you know, getting back into regimental life again. I got shipped off to one RTR, so this was a pairing arrangement that the two regiments quite often do. So the thing is with one RTR, it's like they're not all tanks. So 2 RTR was just purely tanks, T-farms, out front line, whatever. 1 RTR was half tanks, but they were like the demo squadron. So they would always go down to Salisbury Plain whenever there was like some sort of big exercise, or they were trialing new kit or doing whatever. Half the squadron would be used for that. And then the other half was CBRN.
Okay, which
so is chemical, biological, nuclear, and radiological warfare.
Nice.
So I was attached to the CBRN side of things, and at first I didn't want to go. I even threatened to sign off. I did sign off. I was like, "You can't make me go. I don't want to go." They're like, "Well, you can. You're going." I was like, "Well, I'm going to sign off then." And they were like, "Go on then, do it." So I was like, "All right, I will." So just that was the one thing I sort of didn't like sometimes, is that, you know, you had to go do something. This was a 2-year posting.
Oh, right. So you were posted there.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. I was posted away for 2 years. Turned out, I absolutely loved it. It was great with the doing that. Moving up to Suffolk. My regiment had just come back to the UK anyway. So we went from Fallenbostel to Tibworth.
Well, down so, that's, to so then both yeah, RTRs so, were in the UK?
Yeah, so both RTRs right. are now in the UK.
Right.
That was just as... the UK were pulling, British forces were pulling out of Germany.
Okay.
So they were starting to break down all the big garrisons and all that sort of stuff.
What year is this, back. Roughly?
That would have been about 2008, I think. That's when we came back to the UK, because we had to pack up our regiment as we went out to Afghan. So we not only was we packing up to go on tour, we packed up the whole regiment at the same time. So we came back off R&R straight into Tibworth. Which was it wasn't a brand new garrison, but all the blocks that we moved into were brand new, like nothing worked, everything was falling apart.
Right,
so,
right.
So I got shipped off to Suffolk, up at RAF Honington.
Okay.
What I thought I knew about NBC stuff soon become apparent. I didn't know nothing. So I had to learn how to do all the light roll team stuff, all the LRT. So with the CBRN, all we ever did was detect. So then you'd get the RAF guys. There was an RAF unit that would do a lot of the cleanup and all that sort of stuff afterwards. So all we ever used to practice was live agent. Well, wait, you practice going into situations and detecting what was in there. How to mark it, how to clean it, how to pull out, decontaminate, and everything else. So, we went to Portland Down. It's down in Dorset as well, isn't it? And got to knock up some sulfur mustard and all that sort of, see all the VX and, you know, all these live agents that aren't in the UK, apparently. there was only small samples and stuff, but we had to learn. You know, if you're going to handle this stuff, you need to be able to see it in real life and stuff. So we saw how sulfur mustard is made up. And then you got all the old World War II shells and stuff that they're still trying to get rid of. And then any other countries that have used chemical agents and stuff, you know, it all goes down to the Portland Down to be destroyed. So it was cool to see all that. And then, you know, we'll go out to Canada from time to time. Have you ever been out to Canada?
No.
No.
I'm one of the few that haven't.
Missed out. Suffield, you go out to Battus and massive, massive training area where you can just create a war without actually going to war. It's brilliant. But there's one part of it, the Cameron Centre, where they actually have like live agents. You do all the radiation, you know. The that's what I put it down to, like the brain cells and stuff with me. So like, all the amount of like, radiation I've been zapped with and stuff like that. It was like, you know, it's killed too many brain cells. But it was really interesting, like using concrete walls as barriers and stuff, like how you advance to find where the radiation's coming from, like especially with the gamma radiation, because that's the one that travels through most shit. The alpha and beta is just, you know, it's heavy. It doesn't really move about. So understanding all that lot was really exciting. It was really good, really cool to learn. And one of the courses, you know, dare I say it, you have to plan a terrorist attack. So they kind of tell you, like, what are you going to do? You have to plan a terrorist attack. And mine was sulfur mustard. And how would you plan to do this attack? So it was really interesting. But then you're going on Google, looking at all the Dr. Death's, like, book of, you know, all sorts. And as you're kind of looking on the internet, you're expecting a SWAT team to come through your window or something.
Yeah.
You never really know what's going on. But then, you know, they were saying, like, you have to plan, you know, how would you kill someone with radiation and all that sort of thing. So it kind of really made you think. And I found that really interesting because as much as tanks are cool, rolling across cross-country and when it goes bang, it's like a really loud bang. It's like, ooh. But with the live agent training, it kind of really stimulates the mind with what you're doing and stuff. But that was only kind of every now and then. A lot of the time, you know, normal daily life in the regiment is quite, you know, it's quite flat, isn't it? So
with that CBRN stuff, are you wearing the same kit that we would be issued? Or
yeah, so you got your normal respirator.
Yeah.
Does fuck all.
Really?
yeah. So, I mean, the respirators are there to just help you win the firefight. So it helps you get to the end. I mean, I'm sure the new ones are way better than what they were.
Yeah, they got new ones, didn't they? Yeah.
Yeah, but a lot of the time you needed the BA gear. You needed like all the big, you know, the big green biohazard suits and the chem suits and all that lot. And you wear all the breathing apparatus underneath it. Right, that's the only thing that's really going to save you from a lot of stuff.
Right.
But
so the issued stuff that was stuff in the side pouch.
Yeah. Those were no, exactly. And it's like you get, you know, to do the clear test and that. It's like you take your respirator off. It's like, fuck off. You take yours off. Is it the Monty Python sketch where he's like saying about advancing to the contest? No, you go. I don't want to go. We'll have a cup of tea instead. All right. So yeah, it was kind of it was an eye opener doing all that, and then you know there was. With some of the live agent training, you had VX on a dish in front of you, and like if you get that, if you inhale that and all that, like you're fucked. It's horrible, and you feel this bead of sweat come down the side of your face. And you're like, oh shit, as my respirator, have I broken the seal? Is it? Oh my god! And everything that goes through your mind, you just see this like petri dish of live agent and just the thoughts that go through your head, and then all of a sudden, you know, you're like, oh, I feel a bit dizzy, what's going on, oh my god, and you're like, you really have to just take a step back, take a deep breath, and this is just you know, it's an exercise, there's nothing really going on. It's not like you're back out in Afghan in the shit or anything like that. It was just, but then that's another thing that I loved about the army, like the way it just puts you in all these uncomfortable situations and how you handle it and how you deal with it. You know, I loved it.
So after the 2 years there, do you go back to RTR?
Back to 2 RTR.
Okay.
Yeah, so where I enlisted, where I threatened to sign off, my sergeant major talked me into it. There was a bit of a recession going at the time. And he's like, what are you going to do when you get out? I'm going to do CP work out in Iraq. And he's like, fuck off, mate. Like, that market is saturated. Like, you're not going to earn, I think people were saying, you're going to earn £8,000 a month, like, tax-free, get all the Gucci kit and all this lot. It's like, well, yeah. But you're still out in Iraq. You're still, you know, if you get shot at, you're on your own. You haven't got the British Army, the help of, like, all these Apaches and all the, you know, the aircraft coming over. You're on your own. And I was like, it's still not so bad. But then, you know, my sergeant major, he was a good guy at the time. He talked me into signing back on, and I did. And then At the time, previously, we was doing some training to go out to Kosovo.
Okay.
And it was India company at the time. And the training for that was really, really intense. So these guys were going out. They were doing we were going out doing an 8 mile march with probably double the weight normally have to do a tab. So I think it was what, 27, 30, 20, about 25, 30 kilos or something on your back. So we were having double that. We were doing the 8 mile march to then, as soon as you cross the line, you had to dump your Bergens off. You had to do then, it was the ACFT. So it was a mile and a half run.
With like your webbing and
stuff. But with your webbing and boots.
Yeah.
And then as soon as you cross that line, you have to dump all that and then do your BPFA, which is your basic fitness test, which was the mile and a half in under 10 and a half minutes. And then you had to do all your bloody carries and all that lot. And this was all in one go. And a lot of the guys, when they first selected for Intercompany, they had all the build-up training to it. But so many people got broken and injured. They were just drafting anyone in. And as I was part of recce troop, you know, it was always the colonel's blue-eyed boy sort of thing, recce troop going out, you know, being beyond enemy lines and all that shit, blah, blah, blah. But my troopie at the time, my troop leader, we went out for a run, and little did I know, anyone who beat him back off the run was then going to go to India Company. So I was the first one back in, beat him off a run, and he's like, "You're going to India Company?" I was like, bollocks. Didn't want to go, but started the training, and where I started so late, everyone else is like super fit, super strong, smashing it, and I really struggled. My fitness at that time, you know, wasn't up to scratch where it needed to be, so I was getting pushed across the finish line, the tabs and that, where they were doing like 8, 10, you know, 12 mile tabs. My shins were getting smashed, and then we went down to Lydd to do COP course. I think it was like a counter surveillance thing, and you learn how to set up all these OPs. You were doing like nighttime insertions and all that sort of stuff, setting up into a bush. And one of the first things you do is a 8 mile march, and it's like you finish the last mile across like beach shingle, and my feet just went numb. And they were slapping on the floor, and I ended up getting compartment syndrome in my legs. So, the last year of Honington, I actually got the chance to have surgery on my legs to have decompression of the calves. So I did that, and I was going through all the rehab. And then,
what is this? What year is this?
This is second year of Honington. So it was 2008, borderline 2009.
Right, okay, yeah.
Because we went out to Afghan on the second tour, 2010, yeah. So had the surgery done,
yeah.
Going through rehab, went back to finish my 2 years at Honington,
right,
to go back to Tidworth. And I was just starting to get my fitness back up when everyone was like, right, we're going to Afghan again.
Okay.
And I was like, oh, right. So at this point, I was still downgraded because I and done the required fitness test to be upgraded. And I kind of got told I needed to pull my finger out and do it. So to get upgraded, I had to do 8 mile CFT on a fucking treadmill. It's the worst thing ever.
8 miles on a treadmill?
It was the worst thing I've ever done. It's the most boring, mind-numbing thing I've ever done. But I had to do it to be able to make sure I was able to deploy out on the ground.
Right, right.
Otherwise, I would have been, you know, storming or something like that.
So just what happened with the Kosovo and in India troop and
luckily, I didn't have to do it.
You didn't have to.
Because I got the injury.
Because you got,
I got the injury with my feet.
Got it.
I got taken off it, and that's when,
You got posted back south, down to Tidworth.
Yeah, so that's it. I got posted back.
Okay.
And, I dodged a bullet with that one.
Okay.
As far as I know, everyone was like, it was a great tour, but I don't think anyone actually did too much.
Right.
But,
And then you get upgraded, and then...
Got upgraded.
You head out to
started all the Afghan training. So we went out on warthogs. So,
oh yeah, I've never seen them.
Yeah, so it's like the old Vikings, but on steroids.
Right.
So they've been up my arm at the V-shaped hole, because that was one of the things with the Viking. It couldn't take an IED. There's so many deaths and stuff from the British forces that were out on the Vikings, that they up armoured and upgraded the vehicles, which is really good.
And can you describe what that looks like? Because some people might not even know what Viking...
So the Viking is like the old Arctic BVs. It's like a two-piece. You have the driver's cab, and then it steers in the middle between two cabs. You've got the back half, which is where like the people, or you'd have all your stores and all that sort of stuff. Then you'd have the hydraulics in the middle, and then you'd have the driver's cab with the engine and everything. So it's a tracked vehicle.
And it's on tracks, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. And the off-road capability of tracks compared to wheels is just, you can't beat it. So, the Ministry of Defence spent a load of money upgrading to the Warthogs. We were the first ones out there on those. So we was learning, doing the trials, developing and all that sort of thing. And then when we deployed out, we took control of the Warthogs.
Okay.
And then started from there.
So you get deployed to Afghanistan. You mentioned earlier, I think it was 2010 when this happened.
Yeah.
So, you know, what's that like going out for the second time?
The training was very different. As I was saying before, like the first tour of Afghan was like very kinetic. It was all, you know, small arms fire, and they'll take us on one-to-one. Whereas this time it was more hearts and minds. It was more IEDs. It was more... you know, Barma and all that sort of stuff. You had to think, the rules of engagement had changed. You know, everything was totally different compared to the first time I was out there.
And you got different vehicles.
Yeah,
stuff,
exactly.
Right?
So the Warthogs, yeah, exactly. So, familiarising yourself with that. I can't remember who we took over. I don't know if it was... the Queen's Dragoon Guards or someone like that. It was a Welsh regiment. But anyway, they were still on half Viking and then half their fleet, where they were just starting to get Warthogs going in. I think they had like four or five Warthogs that are out on the ground. So we were still trying to get the vehicles coming into theatre, as well as, you know, getting out on the ground and doing stuff as well.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And yeah, go for the. Yeah. How was it? How was your first period of time out there?
I did my RSOI, all the familiarization stuff, quite quickly, because my sergeant he chose a small handful of people to get out on the ground, and we had to work alongside the regiment that we was taking over. And we was sort of put on vehicles, you know, get an idea of atmospherics, get an idea of how they were doing things and what worked and what didn't. And they were still building Route Trident. Was it Trident?
Sounds about right.
So it was that new road they were trying to put in through Afghan and stuff like that. So you were the engineers, you should know, right?
I wasn't out there.
But we was kind of going down, doing all that, and then the rest of the guys came out onto the ground afterwards, where we went back to Bastion and then picked up the rest of the guys, and then that was it. We'd fully taken over, mm-hmm. and we was out on the ground. So we had one troop was overwatched with the engineers as they was building the road. We had TAC, like the OC and all that sort of stuff, Sergeant Major, and that, they were kind of just drifting between troops as and when. You always knew when they were rocking up. But and then you had a couple of others. We were just down in along the PB line, just sort of doing little ops with supporting where needed to, with like all the infantry and people else that were down there. So, we were just kind of, we didn't have a set job, but we were just kind of going from swapping in and out of you know, doing the Overwatch with the engineers to then going on doing something a little bit more exciting with any of the other units that required us.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, and I was always lead call sign with my troop.
Was you a driver?
I was a commander.
You were a commander.
Yeah, yeah. So,
was you a Lance Jack at this point?
Yeah, yeah. I was a Lance Jack at this time.
When had you been promoted?
A little while before. Again, before I went out to before I got attached to Honington.
Right.
So I got promoted back then.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah, I had a promotion ban and stuff like that. So that was why it took me 12 years to get to Lance Jack. As we were out there, I was always lead call sign. My sergeant kind of always said to me that he trusted me to always get us where we needed to be. Sometimes I needed a little bit of help. Trying to map read as you're rolling across the ground isn't always so easy, especially in the desert. So some of the guys struggled, but, you know, miraculously, I managed to get us where we needed to get to half the time. So, I was always lead call sign. And then, we went on a couple of missions and stuff. And then we got attached to the Paras. It was D Company, I think, 2 Para. And we was along the PB line, PB2. I don't know if anyone ever knows where that is. It's... But it was just outside of Fob Price and around the back there. So we was along the PB line and the Paras took over a compound just behind PB2 and they couldn't get any supplies down to it. So they took a lot of casualties trying to get like battle defences and all that sort of thing down to the compound they'd taken over. So they called the Warthogs down for our off-road capability. So I think the Paras had a couple of vehicles blown up and all sorts, and they couldn't get what they needed down to the guys without taking casualties. So we was asked to go down, and I don't know if it was like a condition or what, but they kind of said, right, the day before, we're going to go down, we're going to go out, and we're going to go on an op, and it's going to be carnage, it's going to be mayhem, it's going to be crazy. And so we went down fully locked and loaded, expecting like Armageddon,
right?
And then we went out on this op and there was absolutely nothing.
Okay.
And they kind of said like, oh well, we've never advanced so far in one day as what we've done today. And they just said it's because of the Warthogs. Like, I don't know if it's because the Taliban had never seen them before, they didn't know how to attack them, they didn't know the capabilities or what. And not a single round. Normally, like, there might even be just like a pot shot taken against us, but it was nothing. So we was like, fuck's sake. So went back to the PB, and the next day, two of the full screws needed to secure their job. So you have to be a troop full screw, and to secure your job, you have to take on the role as like the troop corporal. So they came up with the op to send the defense stores down to this PB. And the first day, Smudge, he was the troop corporal, and he comes up to me, goes, right, all right, Murray, I want you to be lead call sign. You know, I trust you, you've been doing it, you know. And you're going to get you to lead the convoy. So this is where we need to go, A to B, you know, whatever. And I actually had a new driver. So my driver beforehand, he was getting fretters with being lead call sign all the time. He's like, fuck, say, why have we always got to be the lead one? His nerves were just shot to pieces. But then as before we left Bastion, yeah, DMV.
Timing.
Yeah. So, I mean, he was a gym bunny.
Right.
And he was massive, and he could see all his gains just shrinking away. And I'm not saying he did it on purpose at all, because I don't know. Chances are he did have DMV. But, you know, there was always that speculation. So I had a new driver. And, you know, he didn't know how I worked. I don't know what he was like as a driver. But you know, he was a nice guy. He was a good friend up until that point. But my driver beforehand, he was on the ball. So when he was driving, he was looking at all the ground sign. He was looking for anything that was not right or whatever. Because as a commander, you're map reading. You're looking around for people. You're looking at all these dodgy signs. Out in Afghan at the time, you'd have all the piles of stones that indicates like an IED or anything that's not familiar. As well as, you know, you're talking across two nets and you're telling your driver what to do and he's telling you that he's hungry or whatever. And you just got so much going on in your head. You need a driver that's going to be on it. So then you can just take away one little bit of pressure to carry on with what you're doing. So this new guy, he didn't understand that straight away. So this first day we went out on this op, we was going around this corner and I was like, you're not going to make it, mate. You're not going to make it. And he's like, I will make it. I was like, you're not going to make it. He goes, I will make it. I was like, stop. And he kept going. He put my vehicle in a ditch. So I'm like, you fucking arsehole and all this sort of stuff. And we had to then recover the vehicle back. And then we actually made it down to the patrol base and got the stores down. But as we were going along the Helmand River, there was this real one sketchy drop off. And we knew that if we went down that route the following day, one of the vehicles would be going in this drop off, because it doesn't take the brains of an archbishop to put an IED or something near it to collapse the banking and then, you know, make life horrible for us. So the next day we had to choose a different route. I was going across these fields, like just probing these irrigation ditches. Some were too wide, some were just not right. And I found this one spot, went over this irrigation ditch and it was straight into a farmer's field. But there was rocks down the side. So I was a bit hesitant. But this farmer's like just plowed his field. I'm like, well, if he's stupid enough to plow the field, I'm more than stupid enough to drive across it. Surely it's proven ground, right? But we drove across it, got all the supplies down over the 2 days, got all the batteries for the radios, sandbags. You know, we even started getting all the parcels down to the paras and that, and they were loving it. Last run of the day, so there's what, 8 vehicles. We've done 4 runs throughout the day, there and back. You know, you always stick to your same tracks because, again, it's proven ground. And so we drove over this pressure plate IED like countless times throughout the day. Last drop-off was heading back, and you know, to be honest, I'd switched off. I was like, pie and chips, what am I going to have for dinner? You know, whatever. And unbeknown to us, the Taliban crawled along an irrigation ditch and connected up a battery pack to a pressure plate IED. They said it was a legacy device, so it had been there for days, weeks, months, whatever, that there was no ground sign. You wouldn't have known it was there. And then me being the lead call sign on the way back, set off this IED and then ruined my day. So, my vehicle got blasted 10 feet up and then I carried on going another 40 feet. Wow. And came down to earth with a thud. And I kind of remember the dust of it, but then I don't know if I blacked out afterwards, but then I remember my friend coming across and he's shouting at me. He's like, Murray, you're right, mate. So I rolled over and I was like, flicked my helmet off. And I was like, fucking hell, Nick, what's happened? He's like, you've been blown up, mate. It's a bloody big one. You should have seen your face. I was like, sorry, mate. I didn't think to give it the thumbs up as I was going up through the air. But we were just kind of chatting like we are now. I was like, fucking hell. And he came up to me by this point. The driver's still in the driver's seat. There was a guy in the passenger seat and he got blown from inside the vehicle to the back half. How he ended up where he did, I have no idea whatsoever. But, you know, he did. And then, yeah, they started doing all the first aid and we then started getting indirect fire from the Taliban. The paras, it was like a scene from Apocalypse Now or something, just literally grabbed their rifles, helmet, body armor, nothing else. So they're like, you know, without as we were talking about before, the uniforms for the British soldiers, you know, you had to be like trousers, shirt, you had to have all the long sleeves and all that from flash fires and all that sort of shit. None of that. Just came out with their flip-flops, body armour, helmet, and then just, you know, started smashing into the Taliban. So it allowed everything to sort of get sorted out. And it wasn't until I was picked up onto a stretcher that my feet, all the bones in my feet, because they were like just smashed to pieces, my feet just kind of dropped down. And that was my first real moment of like extreme pain. Mm-hmm. And then it was at that point they realized, they were like, oh, fuck, his feet. So they supported my feet. But then I don't know if that makes it worse because my feet are now hanging to then pick them back up. And it's like, oh, you know. So they got me onto the stretches. But then every single bump back to Bastion, I felt it. And I was trying to be a man about it. I don't know if I say be a man, but I didn't scream or anything. But I was just kind of, I was gritting my teeth. The other lad, he had his spleen. Well, I don't know what it was, his injuries, but he was like screaming his head off. And one of my good friends and that, he was the ambulance commander. And he's saying it traumatized him afterwards because it wasn't the fact of what he saw or anything like that. It's just the screaming in his ears. Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. So that's, it was a big thing for him. But so we got back to PB2. And I'm just sort of asking my mate, I was like, give us a cigarette. He's like, you can't have one. Mert's inbound, 60 seconds. I was like, I can smoke in 60 seconds. Don't worry about it. Like, you can't. Obviously, when you're injured, you've got to keep your oxygen levels up and all that sort of stuff. And smoking's, you know, blah, blah, blah. But, so I got back to Bastion. And then they got these, like, wooden carts with the big wheels, like, they wheel the casualties in. They're wheeling me in. And I'm just having a chat, like you and me, with like all the hierarchy and that from the 2IC and the OC and all that lot, as they were wheeling me back in. And then I don't know if it was the drugs or what, but I just must have blacked out, whatever. And then next time I come around, I was in this bright white room, and I look up and all I can see is white. I'm like, fucking hell, I haven't made it up here, have I? And this voice in the background is like, nah, mate, you're having an MRI scan, you're in Bastion. So thank God for that. So, there was that. And then back onto the ward in Bastion, I just seem to remember, like, just dry humping the bed, going, don't worry, boys, this time tomorrow I'm going to be humping my missus and all this. And I think that was the mentality that I've just always had. Like, I've always used humour through shit times. And come back to the UK within, I think it's like 24 hours. And then the surgeon's telling me that I've got severe fractures to the feet. And I thought, right, well, 6 weeks, I'll be up and motoring in no time. But I didn't realise, like, severe fractures means that there's no bones left intact in your feet.
Right.
And they've got to be amputated. So within 36 hours, I was then a double amputee. One of the nurses, like, she was looking down at me. And she was like, have you seen that bruise on your ribs? And I sort of sat up to look at my ribs and everyone's jumping on me going, don't move, don't move. I was like, what? Like, you've broken your back in 6 places. I was like, well, don't fucking tell me to look down at my feet there. Look down at my ribs. So, I was in intensive care for about 2 weeks, but I, all the bones in my feet were just shards. Broke my hip. Broke my back in 6 places, ripped liver and spleen. And then I always joke about the worst one was the cut across my nose. Like, you know, any squaddy, you don't want nothing affecting the face, do you? So, that was the extent of my injuries. And then I was in hospital for about 7 weeks, I think, in total. And then off to Headley Court for the rehab afterwards.
Okay. Well, first of all, thanks for sharing.
That's all right.
All of that. But that's an awful lot of injuries. One, to only be in hospital for 7 weeks. But two, you mentioned about being in pain once the foot dropped, but you didn't feel any of the others during that time.
No, I don't know if it's down to adrenaline. I'd like to think that I've got a reasonably high pain threshold. Anyway, but I honestly don't know. I mean, all the time that I was laying on the ground and my mate was talking to me, you know, I remember it. And I think it was only at the point that they started to start giving me morphine and stuff like that, that my memory was then affected. Thankfully, they gave me the morphine before they put me onto the stretcher. Because maybe I would have screamed a bit more. I don't know.
Okay.
But, yeah, it was really weird. Like, none of the injuries really played a part. Like, when I was, because you get flown back to the UK, I was in Birmingham up at the Queen Elizabeth, the new hospital there. And I was laid on a bed that was kind of propped, not upright, but at an angle. And it was the most uncomfortable position that I've been left in. I was probably, it felt like hours. And I was getting so pissed off because I just wanted to move. And they wouldn't let me move. And that was probably the worst part of coming back to the UK and getting blown up and everything else, was just being left in this one position because I was awake throughout all of it. The flight back, I was awake. You know, I don't know if it was the pain management that they were, you know, the drugs they were giving me. I was having a right old chin wag with the nurse on the flight back as well. So, yeah, it was really weird to be conscious throughout all of that. Everyone's like, do you remember it? I was like, yeah, clear as day.
Mm.
But, you know, it's every time you talk about it, you always remember different things, or you always talk about different things. So it's really weird, you know, talking about it. As though I don't have a problem talking about it. I talk to anyone about it. Yeah, it's funny how the mind, how the memory works each time. But yeah.
Yeah. The others in your vehicle, do you know?
Yeah, so the driver had a closed fracture to his heel. No, open fracture to his ankle, closed one to his elbow. He was out of action for 6 weeks, and then he was redeployed back out.
Okay.
And then the passenger, he was a single amputee to start with, and then he had broken bones in his other leg, but through various pains, infections, whatever, he opted to have the second one taken off as well. But yeah, we all survived. Everyone on our tour survived. We had a few casualties on that one.
Okay.
But yeah, everyone survived, which is, you know, obviously really good. Mm. I think there was about 8 of us going through Headley Court for all the rehab stuff at the time. So it was kind of good to have some familiar faces, but shit that they were there
with
the injuries as well.
So in regards to your amputation, double amputation, whereabouts did they do that?
Halfway down the shin. I've still got my knees, which is, you know, the best thing.
Mm-hmm.
You get to Headley Court and you're like, fucking hell, I'm going to be the worst one injured there. You know, woe is me sort of thing. And then you get there and there's, you know, some pretty messed up guys going all through their rehab, like triple amputees, like the height of the amputations. A good friend of mine that I went through Headley Court with, Jack, he's pretty much up to the waist. And then to see that, and I was like, you know, the guy was classified as dead, like, God knows how many times. He was in hospital a long time. And then when he came into Headley Court, I was like, well, fucking hell, you're going to trump me now, aren't you? But everyone was so chilled, like, everyone's so humble when you get to Headley Court. And it was just, it was a real eye-opener, and it was like just chatting to these people and, you know, what they were going through. And, you know, everyone sort of laughs at me saying my injury is a buck sheet, you know, because I've still got my knees. If I was a through knee or above knee amputee, my rehabilitation is so much longer.
Mm.
So I was actually, from the point of being blown up, I was walking within 3 months.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. So really, really quick. But if I was a double above knee, it can take up to a year, 2 years.
Mm.
You start on stubbies and then you get the C legs, and it's getting balance and everything else, learning how to walk again. So I think within 3 months I was walking, 4 months I was running on blades, five months I was riding motorbikes.
Okay.
So yeah, it was really, really quick for me.
And is that a little bit of your kind of like guts or grit and determination?
A little bit, yeah. I think every squaddie is impatient. You know, that's one of the things, isn't it? Like, we get told to hurry up and wait. Your whole army career, you're like, wait, 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 wait. So you're just impatient, aren't you? So to go to through the rehab, like if there's an opportunity to do something, like I want to try my first prosthetics. They get your prosthetics on. I want to walk with crutches. I'm going to walk with crutches. And then you're between the parallel bars and you're taking your first steps unaided. You know, it's a big thing. And I remember getting my prosthetist to take a picture and video it. And I was just sending it to all my family and that. And my fiance at the time, you know, she broke down into tears and all sorts. So yeah. It was a real big deal. But then it was kind of, right, what's next?
Okay.
So then So I had to learn how to run. One of my goals for my rehabilitation is that I wanted to walk, because I was engaged, but I got engaged just before I deployed out, actually. So one of my goals was to walk down the aisle unaided without any walking sticks, crutches or anything like that. And then when I realised how easy it was to get walking again, I was like, oh, fucking hell, I better learn how to run. So if I get cold feet, I can leg it down the aisle the other way and then just bolt again. But it was just all these little goals, these little targets that I had that made my rehab journey so much easier. Yeah. You know, I didn't want to say everyone owes me, because no one owes me shit. I joined the army knowing full well what I was going to do. So I accepted that, you know, being blown up, I guess, was one of the perks of the job, wasn't it? So, you know, you go to a war zone and expect people not to shoot you, you're mistaken. So, yeah, I had no grudges. So many people say to me, you must hate the Afghans and that for what happened and that. It's like, no, I they're not my best friends, but I respect them. You know, if it was the other way around, if Afghan was invading the UK, what are you going to do? You're going to defend yourself. You're going to defend your family and everything else. And you're going to do it by any means possible. You know, if someone's close to you, you're going to want to protect them, right? So it's just shit the reasons why we were out there. Mm-hmm. You know, to try and civilize, to make an uncivilized country civilized, they didn't want it. And you've got to accept that. But hey, that was down to politicians, right? Mm. So
What was the date that this happened?
9th of December 2010.
9th of December 2010. Okay, yeah. Okay. And when did you get married?
Fucking hell. Now you're going to put me on the spot. August.
August, the following year? It's
yeah,
like 2011?
2011, yeah.
So yeah, that's quite a tight goal, you know, to be doing that. But well done for getting back to it. I know to you that's like, shut the fuck up, probably. But to us who, you know, get to watch you go through something like that, it feels like it's a well done for.
Yeah, well, exactly. I mean, it's for me, it's not a well done. It just had to be done.
Okay.
But then, you know, this is me living my life. I mean, I guess from other people's perspective, I've always kind of cringed when people say to me like, "Yo, you're so inspirational and everything else." I'm like, I'm not. I'm just normal. I'm no different to anyone else. But you kind of learn to think, well, if I can make someone else get off their ass and potentially try and do something good for themselves, then I'll take that. You know, it's, yeah. You know, it's too easy to just give up.
Mm-hmm. It is. And then you mentioned Headley Court. So sadly not there anymore.
No.
But you know, that was our...
That wasn't my fault, by the way.
That wasn't your fault. No. But a great place. And how long was you there in total through rehabilitation?
For me, I think about 8 or 9 months. We'll call it a year. I was going through... I had to keep going back to Headley Court all the time that I was in the army. So I had my medical board. It was at that point they turned around and said, like, you've lost your feet. You're no longer deemed employable. Right. You're going to get medically discharged. How they said that to me was the shittest way in the world. Like, I've always laughed and joked and said, the blood is green that courses through my veins, right? I was going to do 22 years and then some. I had no plans of leaving the army. So then when someone turns around and says to me, you're getting discharged, I was like, well, there's still jobs I can do. I can be a storeman, you know, all the jobs that I hated before, I can still do it. But they said, no, because you're taking the spot of someone who is deployable. And I was like, yeah, but there's always going to be someone at the regiment, or, you know, rear party and all that shit. It's like, you know, there is a job for me. And I argued, and they just said, no, that's it, end of, you're getting discharged. It probably was the best decision, looking back, because if I did stay in the army, would I still have my military pension now? Who knows how it would have affected it. And, you know, the way the army has changed, I've always said, the thing is with the army is only as good as the people in it. So if you've got a really good bunch of guys, that's what makes the army so great. The job is shit, but the people, any, like, you could have the best job in the world, it always becomes boring. But the people that you're with, that's what makes it good, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, if I had stayed in, would I still be there now? Would I still be enjoying it? I don't know. Would I still be a Lance Corporal? Probably. So it was just a really hard pill to swallow. And it, like I say, how they said to me, like, you're getting discharged, that's it. Accept it.
Okay.
Tough shit. So I was kind of holding on to the door frames
because
they were trying to pull me out the door.
Right.
And the welfare officer that was there at the time from my regiment just sat there, didn't say a single word, didn't try and defend me or encourage, you know, to say how good it is or whatever. That was shit. And my regiment was a bit poor, to be honest. People put it down to the fact that, like, the paras, the Marines and all that lot, like, unfortunately, they had loads of casualties. So their regiment was really good at looking after the guys that were injured. But the regiments that hadn't been deployed that much didn't really know how to deal with the injured guys, or there was only maybe one or two. My regiment was actually really shit. You know, whether it was their fault, well, I guess it was their fault. There's no way of putting it. But, you know, the homecoming parades and stuff like that, I didn't get invited to a single homecoming parade. I got invited to the medals parade, but because I'd already been to Afghanistan, it's not even like I got a medal or anything. You just kind of stood there. Everyone's like, look at the guys that are on crutches. Oh, bless them. And then that was it. You know, I was forgotten about again afterwards. So that was hard. And then my OC at the time turned around and said to me, like, if I hadn't been blown up, I would have been promoted. I was like, how the fuck can you turn around and say that?
Why would you say that?
Yeah, exactly. So that was hard. And then the rehab units, they could have promoted me if on recommendation, but they turned around and said that it had to be the regiment and everything else. And I just thought it would have been a nice parting gift to actually have been promoted instead of everyone telling me I should have or would have been promoted.
Yeah.
So yeah, it was just a bit bitter my last few days.
A bitter end.
Yeah.
So you get told about the medical discharge. How long did they give you? Was it a short time?
It depends. Depends on where you're at with your rehab. Once you get told you're being medically discharged, Headley Court then have to turn around and say, you are not going to get any better than where you're at. So with your rehab, so I'm not going to walk any better than where I am now. I'm not going to walk it, run any better or whatever. So once you've come to the end of the treatment that they can give, that's when you get discharged. And that's when everyone's saying to you, right, we've got a massive pot of money for you to retrade. What do you want to do when you grow up? You know, what's your next job and all this shit? And I was like, I don't know. I wanted to be a soldier. So
that was going to be my next part there. So, like, when you were leaving, what was your mind doing with that transition back to civilian life that essentially has been forced upon you, not through choice, right?
Yeah, no, I didn't want to go. I had no clue. I just kind of left quietly into the night. I didn't know. I had no idea what I wanted to do when I left the army. So, I just kind of went to sitting at home watching Jeremy Kyle, looking at other people's lives, thinking, well, mine's not quite as bad as that, as I'm eating biscuits and cake and doing God knows what. So, that was the downside. And then I brought a motorbike to ride back on the road to cheer myself up. And it was at that point I met a guy through a charity and he wanted to start an injured serviceman's motorcycle race team. So between the two of us, I converted my road bike to a race bike. And then we started an injured serviceman's team called True Heroes Racing. And I use my bike, got all my race licenses, done everything myself, used a lot of my own money to do it. And that kind of gate started to give me a sense of direction again. And I don't know if it was adrenaline or what, but from riding the motorbikes. But I loved going out racing, and then to be a part of a team that helps other injured service people come along, you know, chew the fat, do the whole rehabilitation together, camaraderie and all that sort of thing. It all just felt really good at the time, and I felt that it was, I had a purpose again. So that, then I went to college to do my motorcycle maintenance, and I became a motorbike mechanic, and then just did that for a couple of years. And then as the team grew, I realised with the racing I needed to get fitter myself. So I found a gym. It was a CrossFit gym. So, yeah, I didn't realise the cult that it was a part of at the time. But I started doing CrossFit, and that's when I met Barnaby, who's my coach, and who's now my business partner. But, he really encouraged me to get back into fitness, do a little bit, a few CrossFit competitions over in America and stuff like that. So I started getting some purpose again.
Mm-hmm.
Work-wise, though, it was only really kind of training with Barnaby doing the CrossFit. Everyone's saying to me, you should become a PT. You should get into fitness. You know, it's inspirational, blah, blah, blah. And I thought, if nothing else, I could just make a killing out of it because people would want to know my story.
Okay.
And it was the case. So I trained to become a PT, and I started working at Virgin, then David Lloyd, and all the old and bold loved me because, you know, being an ex-serviceman coming from a military background, got no legs, they'll come and talk to me. I've always been friendly. I always love a good story with some of the oldies, and I just loved it. But the downside to that was that I was always targeted. And I hated the fact that I was being told that I had to talk to people, target sales and everything else. So that's when I stopped PTing in the gyms and then did my own thing.
Okay. And what's your own thing?
Well, at the time it was just PTing at out of my garage.
Okay.
And then me and Barney kind of put our heads together and said we were going to open up our own CrossFit gym together. So we now have a CrossFit gym in Pulborough in West Sussex. And been doing it for the last 3 years.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it was funny though, because the day we finished building the place was the day that Boris put us into lockdown. So my impeccable timing struck again. And just was about to open the door to say welcome. And it's like, oh, shit. And I locked the door and go into lockdown. But the good thing for us is that we had no members to please.
Right.
And so we could do things properly, get everything set up properly. But we wasn't entitled to any funding or anything like that because we were less than 6 months old. So, yeah, it was a bit of a struggle financially, but I was all right with my pension. And Barnaby, you know, he was all right at the time with his finances as well. So we managed to scrape through.
Mm-hmm.
And as soon as we opened the doors, then that was it. We was away.
And it's been going well since?
Yeah, it's been going well since. Managed to do a few competitions. I've competed myself. Done all the Invictus stuff. So, yeah, that was good. Had a few troubles in between that, but, yeah, no, it was going well.
Okay. So you mentioned Invictus there.
Yep.
But before we get to Invictus, I just want to ask about when did you leave? When was your last day in service, essentially?
It was April 2013.
Okay.
I think. Yeah.
Go film on that?
Yeah, we'll take that.
so that, until now, we're recording this at the beginning, very beginning of 2023, and
yeah.
Your episode weirdly comes out on the 10th anniversary.
It sounds like it, yeah.
of leaving, so being a veteran. So in that time, how has it been, looking after your legs and that area? How's it been in that time?
It's all a learning curve, really. So with wearing prosthetics, your walking is only as good as the prosthetics at the time. So the fit can change so easily. The prosthetics that I'm wearing now are a remold of my previous prosthetics because there was technically nothing really wrong with them. I just battered them to the point of where there was cracks. There was carbon fiber coming off all over the place. So I had to do a remold. But this new set, although it's an exact copy of my previous prosthetics, the fit is shit. Like the sockets are huge. So I drop into it. I catch in certain places. Before I could walk a mile quite easily. Now I struggle to walk half a mile. So, and nothing's really changed. So it's getting used to that. And then wearing prosthetics, you get like ingrowing hairs and stuff like that. You wouldn't think something so small could have such a detrimental effect on the way you walk. So stuff like that can make me resort to walking on crutches. Or even worse, you know, I've got a wheelchair in the garage and I refuse to get it out. But I think, you know, I've had it out once in the last year because I wasn't able to walk. And that sets you back quite a lot. Getting used to the point when you've been walking and you have all that freedom to sitting in a wheelchair, like it sucks. Like, mm. People that have ended up in a wheelchair, they get used to it. When you've had that freedom of walking, it's harsh trying to get used to it.
Going back to Invictus.
Yeah.
How did you come hearing about Invictus, and what was your games like, and all that good stuff? So, what can you share about Invictus?
Invictus, I did Sydney. Prior to doing the Invictus stuff. One of my sons got a bit poorly and unfortunately passed away when he was two. So my wife's brother lives out in Adelaide in Australia. And she always said, like, afterwards, like, with all the shit going through, you know, when my son was going through treatment and stuff, that she wanted to go visit her brother. So it just kind of came along at the right time. So I was like, well, do you know what? I'm going to try and get into Invictus. Not because they pay for our flights out to Australia or anything, but, you know, if we're in Australia at the time, you know, it might be a good time to go down to Adelaide. So I tried out for the games, and I got selected for wheelchair racing, swimming, 50-meter front crawl, and rowing. With the CrossFit stuff, I thought rowing, you know, I'm pretty decent at that, and it was my strongest sport. The swimming, fucking hell, it's like disability trumps. And because of my disability, where I'm at, I was competing against guys with all four limbs. So when they jumped in the pool, they would come up like 10, 15 meters down the pool and just annihilate it. Because I literally just belly flop off the diving block and then panic swim all the way to the other end. Like they absolutely, I came dead last. I think there was one guy that was actually sunk like a brick and I actually beat him. But, you know, when you've got someone who's got all four limbs, they've got like a slight nerve damage or something like that. It doesn't really affect their movement. And then there's me that's a double baloney amputee. Like it's the trumps in the sense that I have the worst disability for my group. But I'm not disabled enough to go back into the next group.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, someone's going to come last, someone's going to struggle. And unfortunately, it was me for that. And it was the same for the rowing. But like I say, you know, I had a decent cardio and stuff for the rowing. So I didn't do too bad for that. And the wheelchair racing, although you're going around in a circle in a wheelchair, I didn't actually realise that the Australians were going to bring like the ranked number three in the world para triathlete wheelchair racer. And I'm like, fucking hell, what? When he was telling me what he does, I was like, why are you even here? Like everyone, I think every country, like the UK, Australians, like whoever, always had a ringer that was throwing it in. Like we had a few, like especially with the swimming. And it just made me laugh. And I thought the Invictus was supposed to be like the Warrior Games in America. Like you compete up until a national level. And then when you get to that point, you go to the Olympics. But it really wasn't the case.
And that was 2018?
I think so. Yeah, around then.
Yeah. And so apart from the ringers, but did you enjoy the experience out there? Was it good?
Yeah, I did. I mean, there was a lot of gumph that sort of comes with it. So Team UK, you had to please sponsors and stuff like that. So I didn't like that because it meant that I couldn't be with my family. But I understood what we had to do because of the opportunity it was given us. Like to go compete in Australia, you know, if someone's going to give the Invictus Games £1 million so we can go do that, then I'll go stand in a room and then shake people's hands. I don't have a problem with that. But there was just, there was other nations and that was doing stuff with their families. And our families were like a 45-minute train journey away.
Oh, right.
So you couldn't just go along and see them whenever you needed to. So that was harsh. But the overall experience was still really good. And I'm pleased that I did it.
Okay, good, good.
Yeah.
Did you get to see the rest of the family? Did they come up?
So we went down to Adelaide afterwards.
Okay.
So, yeah, we got to go. She got to go see her brother and, you know, it was all really good. And, you know, we came back ready to crack on with life again.
Well, Murray, I think that brings us up to date, doesn't it?
Just about.
So is there anything we haven't covered that you thought we might talk about?
No, not really.
Cover most stuff.
Yeah, I think so. We talked about the army stuff and that's the main thing, right?
Absolutely. So at this point in the podcast, this is where I give the guest the opportunity to give some advice. And so this first part of the advice is for anybody that's thinking of joining the military, could be the army, could be the Navy, doesn't matter. But have you got any advice for them that are thinking of joining?
Yeah, I mean, other than do it, the opportunities, the experiences that the army or any of the military branches can offer, you won't get anywhere else. So you have to go through that. And not only that, like we talked about before we started, you don't want to have regrets. So at least if you can go through something, you can say, do you know what? I did it. It was a load of shit. I got out. Or you did it. And you served 22 years and had some real rough times, but you had some real amazing times. Like, you know, the adventure training stuff, you paid to do that. You get a brotherhood. You become a part of a brotherhood that's like nothing else. I consider some of my military friends closer family than my own family. And when you talk to any veteran, like the way that you can relate to a person talking, a lot of people wouldn't necessarily understand. It's not like arrogance or anything like that. It's the way that the military makes you, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely.
So to be a part of that, you know, you got to give it a try. And as I said at the start, it is a game. Figure out how to play the game and you'll win. And it's the best time ever. That's what I say to everyone. Like, learn to play the game and you got it. You'll nail it.
Nice. Good advice. And the next part is for any veterans, be that someone about to leave or that's been a veteran for ages, any advice for the veterans out there?
Don't leave. I think don't be fixed on one thing. It's quite easy to turn around and say, I'm going to do CP work. I'm going to do this. I'm going to do that. Quite often it's the biggest mistake, or you'll go into it and you'll hate it. So you kind of got to have be open-minded. Like sometimes you'll fall into a job that you wouldn't even expect to fall into, and it's the best thing ever. So I guess just not to be afraid. There's a lot of people, there's a lot of advice out there. There's you know, social media, you can talk to your friends, like people that have got out before you and stuff like that. Like, you know, looking for work, speak to your friends and see what they're up to. I mean, I know a lot of my friends are getting onto the turbines, wind turbines and stuff like that.
Oh, really? Yeah.
Yeah, so, you know, just don't be afraid. I mean, you're not going to get it right the first go. If you do, you're winning in life, right? But don't be afraid to get that advice. And then just have a direction. Have a general direction and just keep going in it. If you fail, don't worry about it. Dust yourself off. Figure out what you've done wrong and then go again. I think that's been the biggest thing for me is not to give up.
Nice. Some great advice there. So, yeah, Murray, this has brought us to the end. So how was it for you coming on the show?
It's been great. I mean, it always astounds me that people might actually take an interest in my story. I mean, you haven't put it on YouTube yet and you might not have anyone watching it, but, you know, as long as one person can relate, then it's all worthwhile, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Yeah, no, it's been good.
No, I've enjoyed it. So if no one else listens, then I've enjoyed it. So
there you go. There's the one.
It's been worthwhile. But I just want to say thank you for sharing everything that you have shared. You know, I'm sure even though you put on a strong face, some of that might have been a bit more difficult than others. But thank you for that. And thank you for giving some of your time because we don't have infinite amount of it and you've given some of that to me. So thank you for doing that.
No worries. Thank you.
And lastly, I say this to all my guests. Thank you for your service.
Cheers, mate.
No worries. This has been Military Veterans Podcast. Out. Hi, this is Gav. Thanks so much for listening to the end of this episode and I hope you've enjoyed it. But I would love to just give you the insight into being able to support the show through Patreon. You can go to patreon.com/militaryveteranspodcast or you can follow the links on the website or even social media. And this way you can support monthly. There are a few tiers you can choose. They start at £3 a month and they go up. If you were to support with £5 a month, you actually get a behind-the-scenes kind of recording, which is once the episode has been recorded with me and the veteran, then we do a little bit of a chin wag, and that's actually quite fun. So it'd be awesome if you could maybe have a listen to some of those just by supporting with £5 a month. But either way, please share the show with a friend or someone you know that might enjoy it. And also remember, there is the video part as well, which is over on YouTube. So thanks very much for anything that you've done with supporting or listening, and take care. Bye-bye.